So we are speaking tonight again about sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti, the practice of Krishna consciousness. When we come to the stage of practicing raghunuga bhakti, then we'll be motivated to serve Krishna, not by rules and regulations, but out of our desire, more spontaneous, natural desire. But until we come to that stage, then we are motivated by rules and regulations. In other words, we're disciplined by the rules themselves, not that we necessarily naturally want to follow them. Of course, as you advance in Krishna consciousness, it becomes more natural to follow them. But until we become naturally attracted, then basically the prime motivation becomes the rules, the vows we've taken, the desire to please the spiritual master, to follow his instructions. So, recently I've been getting some letters from people, some devotees, who are discussing the difficulties of dealing with material energy, dealing with life in the material world, and remaining Krishna conscious. So I thought perhaps we could speak a little bit about that, about the consciousness that a devotee should be in, or about the attitudes a devotee should have, in dealing with what seems sometimes to be the insurmountable nature of the material world, insurmountable in the sense of overcoming the forces of desire, of conditioning. Even though we try so many times we may fail, or so many times we may think, well, I've overcome the modes of nature, and then a few months later we fall back into it. So how do we deal with that? Well, I wanted to base this discussion on a verse from the Bhagavatam, which is also found in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And it's from a Brahmin. He's a Brahmin from Avanti. And this Brahmin from Avanti, when he came to the point of surrendering to Krishna, he realized that by surrender, by giving his life to Krishna, that he could conquer material nature. And so he chanted a song, or he chanted a verse, which goes, Aham Tarishyami Duranta Tamo. Aham Tarishyami, I will cross over Duranta Tamo, what seems to be the endless ocean of ignorance, where you can't even see the end. And that's a description of the material world. It's like endless ignorance, or endless repetition of birth and death, or endless entanglement of material desire, of trying to satisfy yourself, and endlessly, repeatedly trying to satisfy yourself. There's no end. It's just material existence is always pulling us into another body, again struggling to be happy. Again, we become attached to the body, to the world, again take another body. So he says, Aham Tarishyami, I will cross over Duranta, this great ocean of darkness which appears to have no end. So why is he saying he will cross over so confidently? Because you may think, well, a devotee is not proud, so why would a devotee toot his horn and say, yes, I'm going to cross over material energy. That's what I'm going to do. You think, well, that devotee's proud. What's he talking about? Shouldn't we be humble? Shouldn't we feel feeble? Shouldn't we feel helpless? Shouldn't we feel that we have no power to cross over material energy? Well, the devotee is feeling that way. So his confidence is not based on his own strength. His confidence is based on the process of bhakti. Aham Tarishyami Duranta Tamo. Why? The verse starts, Etansas Ashtaya Paratmanishta. By taking shelter of Krishna or Paramatma and following in the footsteps of previous acharyas, I will be able, or following both the footsteps and the instructions, I will be able to cross, not I will be able to, I will cross over. So what he's saying is, based on following the teachings given by the previous acharyas, following the teachings that Krishna has given us, following Bhagavatam, following the example of the lives of great devotees, if I do that, then it's guaranteed I will cross over the insurmountable ocean of material energy. So when we're practicing Krishna consciousness, if we're not doing well in our Krishna consciousness, then it does appear to be insurmountable. And Krishna says, Daivihi esha gunamayi mama maya duratyaya. My material energy is duratyaya. It is very difficult, or it's seemingly impossible. Have you ever felt that way? Seemingly impossible to get out of Maya or to get out of the modes of nature. Sometimes the attraction to this material world is so strong that we may feel it's impossible to overcome that attraction. How will I ever overcome that attraction? It's just so powerful. So Krishna says that, Davihi Esha Gunamayi. This guna, the divine energy of mind, consisting of the three gunas. Very difficult. Duratyaya could be translated as impossible, but in the context of this verse, Krishna doesn't say it's impossible because he said, by surrendering unto me, you can easily cross beyond it. And that's interesting because in one sense, Krishna is saying it's nearly impossible, and then in the next line he says, you can easily cross beyond it by surrendering to me. So it's really, the real understanding is being in the grip of material energy or being out of the grip of material energy. And when you follow bhakti, you get out of the grip. So therefore Krishna says, it's easily, you can easily overcome it. There are other verses in Shastra like this also. Mahaprabhu says, or Chaitanya Charitamrita says, for one who has the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then difficult things become easy. So here again, what is difficult? Well, the most difficult thing is conquering material energy, crossing over material energy. So that becomes easy. And one who doesn't have the mercy of Mahaprabhu, then even the easy things become difficult. So, for example, it is not difficult, and Prabhupada said this so many times, it's not difficult to follow the principles of Krishna consciousness. So many times Prabhupada said, chant 16 rounds, it is not difficult, only takes a few hours. But then sometimes we think, no, it is difficult to chant 16 rounds. I don't have the time or I don't have the inclination. It is difficult to follow the four regulative principles. And Prabhupada's saying, no, it's not difficult. And Mahaprabhu is saying, easy things become difficult, difficult things become easy, depending on whether or not we have the mercy. So how do you get the mercy? How do we get the mercy? Well, it goes back again to following the practices. If I follow the practices, I transcend the modes of nature. That's what's happening. And then when I'm transcending the modes of nature, it's easy to chant my rounds. It's easy to follow the principles. But when I'm entangled within the grips of Maya, if I'm not following devotional principles, then it's very difficult. Then it starts to seem impossible or insurmountable. There's a nice verse in Bhagavatam. It talks about female attraction, and it describes that powerful kings would go out and conquer their enemies in battle, and then they would come home, and they were so attracted to their queens that they would become like a plaything in their hands and just kind of just bow down to them, basically, to enjoy with them. And so Bhagavatam is showing how such a powerful person is overcome by the power of a woman. And sometimes it's said simply by her glance, her beautiful eyes, then the man becomes mesmerized. He becomes controlled by the woman. So Krishna says, just see the power of Maya in the form of women. Is it how powerful that attraction is, or for women, then it's the attraction of men. It's that power. And so Krishna's saying in that verse, he said, just look how powerful this is. Look how difficult it is to overcome this. And sometimes we feel that way. So it just appears impossible. And then we have this nice example, two stories of Thakur Haridas. Twice Thakur Haridas there was an attempt to seduce him. Haridas Thakur lived alone. He was at this time young and attractive, and he lived alone. So very easy, you would think, for a woman to seduce him in an isolated place, no one's around. So there was one, I believe he was a governor or a leader in that area, and he was a Muslim, and he was very disturbed because Thakur Haridas was a Muslim, and now had become a bhakta, and he was considered a sadhu, and he was being honored as such. And so he wanted to dishonor him, and he thought, the way we'll do it is I'll hire a prostitute, and she'll allure him. He will engage in sexual activity with her, and we'll be there, and we'll get the evidence. And then we'll defame him. So he hired a prostitute. But rather than him falling for the prostitute became a devotee. And the same thing happened again when Maya Devi herself came to test Taka Haridas. But Taka Haridas would not budge. So in the purport to one of those stories, Prabhupada said that this shows how powerful is the holy name. That even the allurement, or the greatest allurement, the greatest attraction in this world, which is sexual attraction, the attraction of a man for a beautiful woman, and how beautiful is Maya. Maya is the personification of material energy. So you cannot not even imagine how attractive Maya must have been. But Prabhupada said, one who takes shelter of the holy name, he can conquer even sexual attraction. And it's interesting when you think about this, that Prabhupada came and his main audience were young people. And at that age, you're at the height of your sexual strength. And not only were they young people, but they were hippies, and they were fully exploring their sexuality. So in one sense, you would think that's an impossible task, to get these people to be self-controlled. What to speak of practicing celibacy, getting men to become brahmachari and practice celibacy. But Srila Prabhupada knew, by the power of the holy name, it's possible. I mean, just think about that. It's really astonishing that that could happen. But it is through the power of the holy name and the power of the process of bhakti that people were able to do this. And Prabhupada had that faith. If he didn't have that faith, he wouldn't be preaching, would he? He would think, well, what's the use of coming to America? These people are not ready. They're not able to follow Krishna consciousness. And then he might think, well, why should we preach to young people? Because that's the most difficult time to control one's sexual desire. I should just preach to older people, 60, 70. They could practice celibacy. But he wasn't thinking that way. So that story of Taka Haridas demonstrates the power of the holy name in enabling a devotee to conquer material nature, conquer over the attraction. So, how do we understand, how do we put all this in perspective in our own life? Number one, we understand that it is not our own power, by our own power, that we will conquer material nature. We can't conquer material nature. We can't fight Maya. But it is by transcending the effects through the process of Krishna consciousness, by transcending the modes of nature, that not that we'll defeat Maya per se, but we'll transcend Maya. We'll overcome Maya's attractions. We'll not be influenced by the modes of nature. So the faith of a devotee is that if I practice Krishna consciousness, if I follow the principles, not by my own strength, but by the power of bhakti, I'll be able to transcend. Mam cha yobi abhichareena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatit daitan. I'll be able to transcend sagunan samatit daitan. Means transcending the modes of nature. Brahmabhuyaya kalpate, I'll come to the spiritual platform. That's the understanding. So in the verse, initial verse we were discussing, aham tarishami duranta tamo, I will cross over the ocean of material nature, or the ocean of material existence. This is an example for us that we should have similar faith, that we should think, yes, I will conquer Maya by following the practices of bhakti. Of course, we could also think that I won't conquer material nature, I won't transcend the modes of nature, if I don't properly practice bhakti. So that's the point, that both things are there simultaneously. So there's confidence, yes, I will transcend, but there's an awareness that I won't transcend if I don't follow. So it's very clear in when you understand these verses that if you don't follow the practice of bhakti, then how is it, where's the strength, how is it that we are going to have the ability to deal with the influence of material nature? We won't. It will simply be acting upon our condition, our former conditioning within the modes of nature, whatever that may be. and then the things which we're naturally attracted to will allure us according to the modes we're in. That's the way Maya works. I mean, you might be more sattvic, so maybe more sattvic things attract you. But even in the mode of goodness, that's not the ultimate goal, is to remain in goodness. We want to transcend. So, understanding this, now we go back to some of the things we had been speaking about previously. If we understand this, then we can understand why Prabhupada was so strict about following the four regulative principles and chanting 16 rounds. Very, very strict about that. Always, always emphasizing that as a bottom line. Now we may think, well, that's a very elevated level. Four regulative principles, 16 rounds. Prabhupada always took that as the bottom line. You must do that. That's the foundation. That's the basis from which you build your Krishna consciousness. And that is a necessary foundation. If we don't have that foundation, then what's going to happen? Well, naturally, what happens is we become attracted to things within this world. The more we're attracted to things in this world, the more it diverts us from Krishna consciousness, the more energy goes there, the more time goes there, the more our consciousness goes there. So then things of this world become more interesting, so we spend more time with them. More time hearing about what's going on in this world, more time reading about it, more time thinking about it, more time learning about what's in this world, what's going on in this world, what are the latest creations of this world, what can I get to make myself more comfortable, better off. That's natural. That's what's going on everywhere. So that's what happens when we're not following some kind of system of bhakti. Those things become attractive because they're attractive to our conditioned nature. Now, bhakti is working against that conditioned nature. So when you're following Krishna consciousness steadily on a regular basis, things within Krishna consciousness become more attractive than things outside of Krishna consciousness. Then we're in a safe position. Everything's okay. Now, we like it. We'd rather hear about Krishna than hear about something else. We'd rather think about Krishna than think about other things. So I'm sure all of you out there have experienced both sides. And when you're experiencing the downside, you can probably trace it back to some kind of slack in your practices of bhakti, some kind of slacking off in your chanting, or it may be not even so much slacking off, but perhaps maybe being overworked or overabsorbed in other things due to necessities, where you haven't had time to practice your sadhana well, or your mind is so absorbed in other things that when you're chanting, you're not really hearing your rounds. And then you'll notice the effect. Because if we're not executing our devotional service well, then we tend to remain influenced by the modes of nature. And so that's just a reality. So the idea of this Aham Tarishami verse, that I will cross over this ocean of material nature, it's to give us both inspiration and also faith. That yes, I can do this. It's not dependent on how great a devotee I am. It's dependent on my willingness, my determination to follow the practices of bhakti. And then if I follow them, the practices themselves will have the effect. So therefore I can say, I will cross over material nature. And then we can add to that, if I follow the practices of Krishna consciousness, we can have that faith. It's like Prabhupada gives the example that sometimes he would walk with his father and he would hold his father's hand. And then when he was holding his father's hand, he'd feel very brave, like he could do anything because he had the power of his father there, that nobody could bother him. Aham Tadishami, I will cross over material nature. I'm holding on to Guru's feet. I'm holding on to Krishna's lotus feet, Mahaprabhu's lotus feet, then I can do it. But if I'm not holding on to it, how will I do it? Now, key ingredient here, and it's kind of sometimes it can be a little bit paradox, as I was saying before, well, if we're determined to follow the practices, then we could say, Aham Tarishami, I will cross over material nature. We can say that, if we're determined. So that naturally some of you out there are thinking, but how do I get the determination? What if I'm not determined? Then I'm in trouble, because then the modes of nature are going to interact with me, and then I'll be pulled by them. I'll be pulled down by them, and then I won't feel this confidence that I can cross over material nature. I won't even feel I can do it because I'm not strictly following Krishna consciousness. So determination, where does it come? Well, something interesting for us to contemplate here is that a lot of times we tell ourselves we should do something. Have you ever told yourself, I should do this? I should chant better rounds, or I should chant more rounds. Or maybe you told yourself, I should get up earlier. I'm sure a lot of you out there, this is common, have said, I should get up earlier. Have you ever said that to yourself, Uddhava? Uddhava says, yes, I should get up earlier. Or I should get up early. Or I should, if I'm not chanting 16 rounds and I really want to, then I tell myself, I should really be chanting. And there's a lot of shoulds that we tell ourselves. But it's interesting. The interesting thing about the word should is that telling yourself you should doesn't mean you're going to do it. Because if you look at your life, you'll see that the shoulds are not what you do. But if you look at your life and you see, when did I actually do something? Was it the should or I must do this? It was the must, isn't it? It wasn't the shoulds. The shoulds are like, yeah, I know, but I'm not doing it. And it's kind of like, yeah, I know, but I'm not going to do it. It's, you know, the should is kind of like acknowledging that I'm not doing what I should do, and I know I should do it, and I'm probably not going to do it because, for whatever reason, there may be, I'm lazy, or I just don't want to, or whatever. I don't want it enough. If you notice in your life, when you do something that you haven't been doing, particularly if you haven't been doing, when you do something and you tell yourself, I must do this, and there's be some history behind that, why you must do it, whatever it may be, whatever the must that you may do, maybe, whatever it could be. There's so many musts. But you'll notice in your life, when you come to a point and you say, I must do this, that's when you do it. And so we want to get ourselves to that point of saying, I must do this. Because that's when we're going to do it. And so the natural question is, well, how do I get to the must platform? What creates the must? Well, that's the big question. So first we understand, if it's I'd like to do this, I should do this, you know, I'm thinking about doing this, maybe next week I'll do it. You know where that takes you, right? Because today, right, today you may not be doing something that you told yourself last week you should be doing. So today is always the day that you should be doing whatever it is you should be doing that you told yourself you should be doing, right? But we say, okay, I'll do it tomorrow. I'll start tomorrow, yeah. Today it's not going to work out. But, you know, tomorrow will be today. When we're in tomorrow, then it's today, and then we'll think, it didn't work out. I'll do it tomorrow. So it's just the way things go. Now, I think the real thing is, I mean, there's a couple ways of looking at this, and we can say that all of them individually can inspire us, or we could say that together, all of them together is what really would inspire us for sure. But we can look at different things, and one of the ways you get to a must is how do you get to a must? Why would you ever say I must do this? It's because there's some reason, there's something you figured out that means a lot to you about doing it, that it's really important to you, and not doing it, you realize how it's adversely affecting you, and how it's disturbing you or making you unhappy or frustrating you or whatever it is by not doing whatever it is you would like to do. And then you realize how important it is for you to do or to do what it is you telling yourself you should do, or you have been telling yourself you should do. And through your meditation and through your life experience, sometimes you come to a point and you just say, I must do this. And then what happens? Is all of a sudden you do it. I'm sure you've all experienced that. Some kind of change in your life just because you just say, I must do this. And it just something happens. And when you do that, it's just all this energy goes into doing that, or you make a decision, I'm going to do this, this is it. I'm, you know, like Like they say, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. So, you know, at a certain point, somebody changes. Some, you know, they hear a lecture or they talk to a friend who went on a diet, who's full of energy, exercising, and you're always feeling tired and you're overweight, and you say, that's it. I'm going to do, you know, just, it's no longer I should, it becomes a must, and then you do it. And that's where you get your energy. So that's one way. Bring it to a must however you can, through understanding why it's important, through understanding how much you're losing out or how much you're suffering by not doing it or how miserable you feel by not doing it. Now, we hinted at one thing, which is you could hear from a friend. Now, here is another point which we've talked about, is association, that oftentimes in association of others, their desires by osmosis enter your heart. And so you want to do what they're doing, that you see what they're doing, it becomes attractive to you. It also works in a negative way, because if they're doing something bad, you may also want to do it. You go, hey, that looks like fun. Let's do that. So you want to get proper association, the right association. And by being around it, it can become a little, what's the word, addicting or contagious. That's the word. Not addicting, but addicting also could be contagious. So I see you doing something, and I see how it's affecting you in such a positive way. I want to do it also, because I see how much it's helping you. So yes, I see how you're advancing in Krishna consciousness because you do this one thing, and I want to do it also. Maybe you're learning verses, and I see you learning so many verses, and I think, oh yeah, I should do it. I should, and I think, no, I'm going to do that. So that's the power of association. A lot of times what association will do is get us from the should platform to the I must platform. I must do this. Because you see the other devotee and you think, this devotee is progressing, and he's progressing steadily, and it seems like I've been staying down here and he's going up here. And you think, no more, I don't want to stay here. I mean, I have to go where he's going. So often good association becomes a must. And we want to seek good association, and oftentimes we want to seek peer association, because peers may sometimes not be doing as well as we are, and that makes us feel good. Or maybe they're doing the same as we are, and that also makes us feel good, because we don't feel threatened that I have to do any better. So we feel kind of comfortable. You know, they say, where ignorance is bliss, it's folly to be wise. So if you're around a lot of the same people who have your same standard, it feels comfortable because you're not challenged. But if you're around somebody who you would consider more or less an equal, but they're advancing more in Krishna consciousness, it challenges you. And that's good. So you don't want association just to pacify you, to make you feel that you're okay. But really, the best association is association which challenges you. I just heard the other day, he said, a real friend will hold you to higher standards, or will hold you to standards which they know you're capable of. They won't let you fall down. And if you associate with people who are more successful in anything, you will tend to be more successful because there's a higher standard there. So anything you want to get good at, associate with people who are better than you. It creates a standard for you to achieve. So same thing with Krishna consciousness. You associate with people who are doing better than you. And then you'll start to feel, I must do this also. This is what I must do. It's the whole point, again, is that must. That must is where things change. Now, what is another reason one might come to this platform of determination? We say, I'm going to do this. Something that I haven't been doing, or something I was formerly doing, now I'm slacking off on, and I need to build up my practice again. Accountability. Accountability means there's another person in your life who you are accountable to, who you say, I'm going to do this. It could be guru, it could be Diksha Guru, could be Siksha Guru, could simply be a friend. It could even be a group of devotees. So you make a vow, you state, this week I am going to do this to a group of friends. Or, you know, you could just call people on the phone and say, this week I'm going to do this. So now you've made a commitment to them, so there's accountability. Or if you have a coach, someone who's working with you one-on-one, and you make some plans to do certain things, and then you're going to have to call your coach the following week, and he's going to ask you, did you do it? So often you might not do it if the coach isn't there from your own willpower, but if the coach is there, and you know, you're going to have to go in front of him and say whether or not you did it, often that's all you need, and you'll do it. Even very, very successful people have coaches. Even people who are extremely intelligent, whose coaches may not be able to help them so much in other ways, but just because of the accountability. That I know I have to go back to this person and say, this week I promised to do this, and there you are. Now, in terms of guru, coach and friends as accountable people is a little different. Because guru, there's a relationship there that's very deep. It can be siksha guru, it can be diksha guru. It's not that relationship with siksha guru cannot be as deep or even deeper than in one's relationship with diksha guru. The idea is that one is motivated, the must comes from the desire to please the guru. Because the guru has given an instruction, and therefore the devotee thinks, I must do this because my guru has asked me. There's no other reason. I mean, there may be other reasons, but that in itself is powerful enough. That if my guru wants me to do this, then even though I don't want to do it, I will do it. So that instruction, because of the faith and because of the affection and the dedication to guru, then instruction automatically becomes a must. We don't debate it. It's just like if you look at Prabhupada's life, when he got the instruction from Srila Bhaktisiddhanta to preach in the West. And he couldn't forget that instruction. And he said that he was married at that time and was not possible for him at that point to give up his family and dedicate himself fully to the mission of spreading Krishna consciousness, although he would have liked to, but he couldn't. But you could see there was a must there. I must do this. It was never in his consciousness that I should do it. I'll think about it. Well, let's see when I'm older how things work out. And, you know, we'll check in when I'm 50 or 60 and then we'll think about it. It was never like that. He took that order and he made it a must. And Prabhupada has written in the purport, he said that is really how he's written a purport in Bhagavad Gita and other places, vyavisatmika bhuti, this fixed consciousness, fixed intelligence. He said, when his guru gave that instruction, that's how he took it, that I must do this. That's his order. So that is the ultimate Krishna conscious motivating factor. We want to please the guru. And because the guru has given the order, I must do this. There's not even a question of maybe. It's not of a question of I should do it. It's a question, no, I must do it because that's the order. So that's where our determination comes from. Now, determination exists everywhere. So it's not just that if you're Krishna conscious, there's determination. No. You see how determined people are who are not Krishna conscious. Because determination exists in different modes of nature. So we shouldn't think that, well, only if I'm Krishna conscious will I be determined. Yes, it's true. You only be determined to execute Krishna consciousness if you're Krishna conscious. But it's not that you can't be determined if you're not Krishna conscious. So many people are extremely determined to become successful as athletes, as musicians, as business people, just tirelessly making efforts. But that's generated from the mode of passion. So determination, it's natural. And one of the things that you'll notice in your life, if you're not feeling determined in Krishna consciousness, oftentimes what happens is that determination is being deviated into something else. So like I was saying before, energy is going somewhere else. So it's not that you're not determined, it's just that your determination went from Krishna consciousness into something else. And so you can notice that in yourself and say, well, where's my determination? I mean, if you're in the mode of ignorance, maybe you won't have determination for anything. If you're in the mode of passion, you'll have determination for something. And that kind of determination may be in some way deterring you from Krishna consciousness. It may or may not. But my point is that don't think that determination does not exist outside of Krishna consciousness, or don't think that if you have determination, that's symptomatic of Krishna consciousness. It's not. There's so many so many reasons people are motivated. And so Krishna consciousness, what Krishna consciousness means, it means motivated by a desire to please Krishna and Guru and the Vaishnavas. It's about motivation. So it's not just that we're after determination. Even determination in Krishna consciousness, if it's motivated to get ahead materially, if it's motivated by recognition, then that's not Krishna consciousness. That's acting with your body in Krishna consciousness, but the motive is wrong, and that's not pure devotional service. So that's not what we want to do. It's not just, I just want to be determined so I can be known as the best devotee, so I'll do some great service and I'll get the recognition, and that's my motive for doing service. That's the mode of passion also. So you're doing service, but it's motivated by passion. It's motivated by the desire to be recognized. So determination in and of itself is not the criterion for Krishna consciousness. It's being determined for the right reasons. Okay, so now we're going to look is if anyone of you have questions. So Catherine is saying, I have many shoulds. The reason I'm bringing this up about the shoulds is so you realize that the shoulds, they're not going to get you anywhere. And the shoulds are really, really the things that you need to be dealing with and turning the shoulds into musts. So every time you tell yourself, I should do this or I should do that, really, if you notice what's happening, if you think about it, it's causing you anxiety. It may be causing you to feel guilty. It may be causing you to be out of alignment with what you know you should be doing or what you know you're capable of doing. Because when you say, I really should be doing this, that means you know it's the right thing and you're admitting that you're not doing it. So now there's something out of line here because you know what you should be doing, but you don't do it. So how does that make you feel? Well, you're not a whole person. You're not integrated. Because there's so many, it's like a person smoking. I'm saying, well, I know it's not good for me, and I know I should stop, but they don't. Or a person is not eating properly. Say, well, I know I don't eat well, and I know, I have this ailment because of my diet, and I know I should change my diet. I know I should be exercising. But they're not doing it. So how do they feel? So it creates this conflict, internal conflict. So every time there's a should, we should understand this. Okay, we've understood something that we should be doing. I know I should be doing this. So we understood. We've come to the point of knowledge. But as I said before, knowledge is not power. Because if you don't act on what you know, then the knowledge is all it is. It's like potentially, it's potential power because you know what you should do. But knowledge becomes power when you do it, when you act on it. And that's when we talk about inquire from the spiritual master, Bhagavad Gita 4:34, inquire from him submissively, render service unto him. So the service is the activating principle. Now you're learning and then you're following the order. So that's when the knowledge becomes powerful because it becomes action. But just to know, it doesn't. If you don't do anything, then you're really not better off than someone who doesn't know. Potentially, you're better off, but at that point, you're not. So, I should do this. I should do that. So that's the signal to us. Okay, we know we're on the mark now. We know what we should be doing, and then ignorance is bliss. So once you know what you should be doing, and now you're not doing it, so now there's no more bliss. Because if you didn't know you should be doing it, then it wouldn't bother you that you're not doing it. But now it's going to bother you. But it's good to be bothered, because being bothered could motivate you, could bring it to a must. So anyway, it's recognition of the shoulds. When you see them, I should be doing this. The interesting thing about the shoulds that I've noticed is they don't go away until you actually do them. So, you're thinking, well, I really should be getting up earlier. Why are you thinking that? You were probably thinking that 6 months ago if you weren't getting up early then. True or true? And you're not going to stop thinking about it unless you go into ignorance is bliss mode. I'm just not going to think about it anymore. I can't do it. Why bother with it? But if you really want to be Krishna conscious, then you have to think about it. It's just, right? You're going to think about it. It's just the way it is, you know. So it's not going to go away. The only way it goes away is by doing it. You know, like you can complain, and here's a problem, but it causes you anxiety. The problem causes you anxiety. But the relief is to do something about it. And as soon as you do something about it, that anxiety goes away, that I'm not doing what I know I should be doing. At least you're making the effort now. You might not succeed, but the anxiety goes away because now you're no longer saying, I know I should do this. Now you're saying, I'm doing what I know I should be doing. So, and if you don't do it, then, you know, a year from now, you're going to say, ah, I know I should be doing this. And so you're going to carry that anxiety for another year. So why carry the anxiety? Just, you know, start, make the effort. You don't have to do it all in one day. Just start. It'll relieve a lot of anxiety. Just make the effort. Oh, I know I should be getting up earlier. So what are you going to do about it? Do something. Take the first step. And then when you do that, you feel powerful. You feel so much better. Yes, I'm actually doing what I know I should be doing. That's self-control. That's discipline. I mean, aren't we supposed to be self-controlled? Aren't we supposed to be disciplined? Isn't that what spiritual life is about? So we can't even do what we know we should be doing. We're not very disciplined. Okay. So, Pallavi is saying, association gets one off track. Yeah, bad association, naturally. And this point about, you know, if you didn't pick up on it, the point about sometimes we don't want to associate with people who are more advanced because it's going to make us feel bad that I'm not that advanced. You know, I'd rather, you know, maybe I could find people who are not as talented as I am, not as smart as I am, not as Krishna conscious as I am, then I'll feel better. I'll feel, oh, I'm doing pretty good compared to them. But that's not smart. That's not the way we make progress, you know. Maybe I'm not wealthy, but I'll hang out with poor people so I'll feel wealthy. No, just hang out with wealthy. If you want to be wealthy, hang out with wealthy people because you'll become motivated. Not that I'm saying, you know, that the goal of life is to be motivated to become wealthy, but the example is there. Or, you know, if you want to be motivated in anything, you be with people who are really motivated, are really good at what they do. Okay. Talking about feeling guilty. So then Balavi is saying the insecurities in the present economic times also take a toll. How to not let that affect our bhakti? Because one spends so much time worrying, juggling between decisions, what to do or how to do. Well, this is my own personal experience. It's not from any shastra, but two things that I see in terms of worrying about situations is, I think one of the ways that reduces worry is just to make efforts to whatever it is you're worrying about to resolve it, to make your best effort to do what you can to solve that problem, whatever it is. Because by making that effort, then it's likely to get better. And if it's not getting better, at least you've got momentum for solving the problem or improving the situation. And if one way didn't work, you can try another way. And so you're working on it. And so naturally, by working on it, you're probably going to eventually solve it. So, you know, some people worry about their financial situation. But if you make an effort to improve your financial situation, you'll tend to worry less about it because you'll understand that you're on the right track to solving it, whatever it is, going back to school, getting a better resume, taking extra training to get a better job, starting your own business, whatever it is, if you're making the effort or saving money or in any way trimming down your expenses. So you're making the effort, and so by making the effort to solve the problem, there's less worry about it. The other half of the equation is to understand what you can't control. You only can make an effort. You do your best, and then you realize there's certain things which are out of your control, and why worry about what's out of your control? They have done studies, and they say 80 to 90% of what people worry about is not going to go wrong, and they have little control. We have little control of many things that we worry about. So there has to be a certain degree of detachment in which we can just accept this is the way things are. This is the way this world is. It's an insecure place. And Srila Prabhupada has said that. It's not secure. And we have to accept that. And the more we accept that now, the easier it is to deal with insecurity if it does come. And not if it does, when it comes. It's the nature of this world. Things will change. People will leave their bodies. People will get sick. People who have money will go broke. People who are broke will gain money. Good, bad, bad, good. That's just the nature of this world. So unless there's some detachment and ability to accept things as they are beyond what we can control, we'll always be worried. We'll always be in anxiety. So as I said, you do your best. Do your best and let Krishna do the rest. As Lakshmi Muni says, do your best and let Krishna do the rest. That's all you can do. I find that a lot of times we worry about things because we're not making any effort to improve them. So, I'm worried, will I be Krishna conscious? Well, you don't have to worry whether you'll be Krishna conscious or not if you actually follow Krishna consciousness well. Then you won't be worried about that because you'll experience that you will be Krishna conscious. Oh, I'm worried about my health. Well, take care of your health. Do everything possible to be healthy. Then you won't have to worry about it. This one person was saying that worry is so bad for your health that some people get so into taking care of their health that they worry so much about it that they get sicker than if they just didn't even take care of their health. So do what you can to take care of what you're worrying about and leave the rest to Krishna, what you can control. What else can we do? So, Manjesh, long time no see. Manjesh, I was just in Atlanta. I was driving through downtown Atlanta and it reminded me of Toronto. It looks just like Toronto. At least it does to me. I don't know if it does to people from Toronto. So, what time is it? It is, okay, we have 7 more minutes if you want to make a comment or question. Yes. I think when we say I should do something or we should do something, I think we can take that as an inspiration, a gift from Krishna that he's pointing us in a certain direction. And so, if I should do this, we could say, thank you, Krishna, you're pointing me in the direction. Now, let's take it upon ourselves to take that gift that Krishna's giving us. Some realization of what should be done, and then let's act on it. Let's do it. Let's take it as some guidance from Krishna. Of course, so many of the shoulds, they come right from Shastra, they come from our Guru. So it's not even an inspiration per se, it's just there it is. But sometimes it takes that instruction coming into our consciousness and becoming an I should instead of a we should, or in Krishna consciousness, it should be done this way. No, it becomes an I should. So an I should means, okay, me, here, now. This is what I need to be doing. Now, it's interesting. Oftentimes what happens is when we're in the wrong consciousness, we tend to look at other people and think, well, what they should be doing. Oh, he should be doing this, she should be doing that. Have you ever thought like that? You see somebody not doing something well or not doing something at all, and you think, oh, he should be doing that. Why is he doing that? So we're very concerned about what other people should be doing. It's not a good platform. And why are we concerned about what other people should be doing? Because maybe we're afraid to be concerned about what we should be doing. So we're so concerned about what other people should be doing. Does that make sense? Yeah, think about it. I mean, really, why would you be that concerned about what other people should be doing? Shouldn't you be more concerned about what you should be doing? I think so. Or what I should be doing? Shouldn't we be concerned about what we should be doing? Yeah. Well, obviously, sometimes somebody's doing something that maybe a huge disturbance, okay, so you want to do something about that. But in ordinary activities, oftentimes we think, why are they doing that? They should do this. They're lazy, or they're not smart, or they're doing something stupid, or whatever. But we're really just avoiding what we should be doing when we're thinking that way. That's the point. That's the idea. Of course, it's easy to judge another person for two reasons. Because if you judge them, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to change. And secondly, it's easier to see what's wrong with another person than it is to see what's wrong with ourselves. So it's double easy, isn't it? It's easy for me to see what's wrong with everybody in the world but myself. And it's easy for me to tell somebody you should change because I don't have to do anything. All I have to say is you should change. Extremely difficult to change ourselves. And it's extremely difficult to overlook another person's fault and to view our own fault. We've talked about this at length. But just making the point of why we do it, because it's easy. I heard something, and I'm going to end this class with that, really, I really like. And the saying goes this way. If something is easy to do, it's easy not to do. So now we've been talking about, I should do this, I should do that, right? I should get up early. I should chant better rounds. I should read the Srimad Bhagavatam every day. I should associate with more advanced devotees. I should. It's easy not to do those things. It's easy to do them, but it's easy not to do them. Yes or yes? Prabhupada said it's easy to chant 16 rounds. Let me tell you, it's easy not to chant 16 rounds. Happens to the best of us. It's easy to follow the regular principles. And it's easy not to follow the regular principles. It's easy to get up early in the morning. Ask all the devotees who go to Mangalartik for the last 20, 30, 40 years. They're up every morning. It's easy. And ask all the people who don't get up early. Say, yeah, it's easy not to get up early. So, look at it. It's not, if we look at it in the proper way, then we can see whatever is easy to do is just as easy not to do. And so when we get in the I should, we're in the easy not to do mode. So it's not that much harder to do it than not do it. So think at it, look at it that way. Not that much harder not to do it. It's not that much harder to do it than it is not to do it. And so that's the position we're in, okay? So I think we'll end here unless someone has a question or a comment. We'll give you a little bit, a little time to think of anything else. And as always, if you want to hear this talk again, it's going to be on Krishna.com. If you go to Krishna.com/Mahatma, then you'll have the audio of all the lectures I've given on Krishna.com for the last few years. If you go to Krishna.com, then you go to video, and then you go to TV, then you'll get some of the older courses on sadhana, maybe not all the new ones yet, but gradually they'll come up. So thank you, Catherine, for coming and listening, and once you come every Tuesday night, we're going to talk more. And yes, and if you have any questions, then you can contact me. And I don't know if I told you, but I've been working on a website. It's called mahatmadas.com. So why don't you go on that website and check it out. You can also link to the audio and video from that website. And all my newsletters are on that website. And so many things on that website. We're actually building a new site called mahatmadas.org. It's going to be even bigger and better. Or as some people say, even badder, which means better. For those of you who English is not your first language, some people, when they want to say it's good in America, they say it's bad. Wow, that's bad, which means it's good. Anyway, you go to mahatmadas.com. You can also reach me there. But my email address, the easiest email address is mahat, M-A-H-A-T, @AOL.com. You can do that. If you go to mahatmadas.com, you can get me there, or mahat@AOL.com, and then you can, if you want, if you have any questions, you can email me. You need any personal guidance, personal problems, then you can contact me that way. And you know, when I speak here, it's general. And then if you have to apply something personally, a personal issue, then if you want to contact me, then we can help you that way, deal with your personal problems. And then that's also very helpful, okay? Thank you very much. We'll see you next week. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.